You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We are on a Sunday afternoon, the 14th of September, 2025, and I just discovered that Labor Day already is gone. I can never keep up with these things. Anyway. I noticed with, for those of you who've been following the work I've done with Pete on Solzhenitsyn, and I think most of you are, the close reading of 200 Years Together, we're now in the spot, after 72 episodes, where we're dealing with the Soviet Union, and we're dealing with the Jewish nature of the Bolshevik Party, and specifically the Bolshevik Party in Ukraine. And I try to, you know, get the information in, the immensely complex information in to the listener, but I'm pretty sure I failed entirely because it's too difficult. What happened between the fall of the Russian monarchy and the imposition of the USSR on Ukraine. So I sent roughly from 1917 to 1921, 22, 23. And it's just very, very complex. So there are two currents of thought around, you know, the beginning of the 20th century. You had the pro-Russian Ukrainians, who were the overwhelming majority. Sometimes they were called Little Russians. The second were much smaller. They could be right-wing, they could be left-wing, but they were Ukrainian nationalists. Now, all of them tried to maintain a Ukrainian cultural and political identity. Its relationship to Russia was the big difference. But most of the great Russian writers and artists had one foot in one country and the other foot in the other. Now, I have a book on this. I've been very pro-Ukrainian. We're talking about here in 2025 is a Jewish oligarchy, working with a Jewish oligarchy in America. This has nothing to do with Ukraine, Ukrainian independence, or Ukrainian culture. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Many of the great eminent Ukrainian writers, Gregory Gavitka, Vladimir Vinichenko, they were all bilingual. They were all, actually, any literate person was pretty, for the most part, bilingual. Nikola Kostomarov, Vladimir Antonievich, these are the great historians that I've read until I was coming out of my ears. The linguist and sociologist, Oleksandr Podobinyan, and so many others, they all had chairs at Russian universities. They published their works in Russian. And that's not to say anything about the ecclesiastical unity between the Ukrainian and Russian people, not to mention the close economic links. Ukraine cannot be a strictly independent country. It has to be attached in one form or another to something more powerful than itself. It's in a very, very rough neighborhood, and still is. Now, the national movements in places in the West, like Galicia and Dnieper, that was long before the First World War, and it goes to the Cossack battles against Poland and the Union. But something changed during the war. the national movement became far more intense, and political theory went along with it. One of the participants of the Ukrainian national movement in that area, in the western part of Ukraine, it was no real unification. They tended to support Austria-Hungary. You had the Radical Party, Social Democratic Party, National Democratic Party, and they all got together and formed the main Ukrainian Council, the GUR. Another, opposed to them, was formed. This is Union for the Liberation of Ukraine, the SVU. Now, that had more of a coherent plan. It was published on September 1st, 1914. That was the creation of an independent Ukraine. A constitutional monarchy, and yet still with a democratic system at the local level, the free development of all nationalities, an independent Ukrainian church. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that sounds great. The SVU relied largely on Germany and Austria-Hungary. We're still talking about 1914. Now, I want to talk about the complexity. I'm talking about this move from the February Revolution and Ukraine in a very general sense. Let me put it this way. Let me summarize it. It went from the Rada to the Hetman, the Directory, to the Soviets. So in all this chaos, you really have four governments that took over, not including the one in the West. So I have to flesh that out. Now, most of Eastern Galicia had been occupied by the Russian army. Galicia had always been considered an ancient Russian land. It's where the Russophiles came from. But in 1915, the situation changed. German and Austrian troops launched a counteroffensive. Russian army retreated. And it was then that the GUR issued their statement on the independence of Ukraine, whatever independence might actually mean. Now, when I say independence, they could be talking about autonomy. There were very, very few people who believed in total independence. Now, in 1916, as a result of the Brusilov offensive, the Russian army again occupied Eastern Galicia. And that was when Austria-Hungary and Germany agreed in the formation of the Polish state, which was to include actually some Western Ukrainian lands. And because of that, the GUR then liquidated itself. The national movement in Eastern Galicia had many factors behind it. The cultural educational organization, they reached out to the peasants in a legitimate way, not in the old populist kind of a way. But during the First World War, you had a few parties operating in Ukraine, including one led by Simon Petlura, USDR run by Vinichenko, who actually condemned the war and demanded the autonomy of Ukraine. Vladimir Doroshenko headed the left wing of the USDR, which called for the fight against Tsarist Russia and stood for the independence of Ukraine. So you had every possible point of view, combination. The Carpatho Russians were always pro-Moscow. They're in the far west. They were always under Austria-Hungary, Hungary in particular. And they created the Carpatho Russian Liberation Committee in Kiev. They wanted to welcome the Russian army into the country to support them. And the committee on the Southwestern Front and the All-Russian Union of Zemstvos and Cities was created for the same reason. But Luria back then, Simon Petluria I'm talking about here, was appointed assistant to these movements in the Western Front. Some Ukrainians with private money maintained soldiers for hospitals for wounded soldiers. And the hospitals were opened by monastics for the most part. And I think, as many of you know, the royal family, especially the females in the royal family, took a crash course on nursing and went straight to the front and worked as nurses. Now, World War I was a mindless war. It benefited only the world's leftist forces, but the slaughter was beyond anything that anyone had ever seen before, and no one possibly could expect it. What were the consequences for Ukraine? And this is the context in which a lot of this is going on. The devastation of Ukrainian, especially in the West, Ukrainian lands, about half of the residential and commercial buildings were destroyed, 2,000 businesses, and oil production was reduced by, well, almost brought to nothing. The human losses were about 500,000. Economic crisis set in. You did have some industry in the East, iron ore production, manganese, steel. And so foreign capital was necessary to maintain these. And then disproportion in industrial development, the rapid growth of military production sectors, and the decline of civilian production. The reduction of areas that could be sown. Roughly almost 2 million diesetins. A diesetin was about 2.7 acres, which led to the reduction of the grain harvest by 200 million poods. Each pood was about 37 pounds, so that's a lot. Same thing goes for sugar production. 85 million poods in 1913 to 50 million in 1917. You started to see lines, you started to see shortages. Reduction of the working age population in the countryside. 1917, maybe 35% of the working age male population remained. Massive social problems and disruptions in transport. And of course, you had strikes. The number of strikers in 1914 was about 30,000. 1916 was 200,000. And you did have peasant demonstrations as well, although the context of these were very specific. That's the backdrop to all of this. So, the First World War was the backdrop for the February Revolution in St. Petersburg. February 27th, 1917, the Masonic Revolution in Petrograd led to the fall of the autocracy. Tsar Nicholas II is said to have abdicated. He did not. That's a lie. I've been through that many times before. Provisional government was headed by Prince George Lvov, and a bit later on by Kerensky. They created their own parallel authorities in some cities and villages. As far as Ukraine goes, after the February Revolution in Russia, Vladimir Vinnychenko serves as the General Secretariat, a representative executive body of Russian Provisional Government in Ukraine. He was authorized by what was the Central Rada of Ukraine, essentially a de facto parliament, to conduct negotiations with this new Masonic state. Vinnychenko, I've read many times, he's vaguely what you might call a national Bolshevik. He saw the Bolsheviks as a means to create a new modern Ukraine. But, you know, he died in 1951, and so he lived to regret that opinion. Beyond all this, you had such fragmentation. The struggle to create unified institutions was severe. So the Ukrainian Central Rada, UCR, was created on March 4th, 1917. That's what we're talking about here. At a meeting of the representatives of the Society of Ukrainian Progressives and Ukrainian Social Democrats, hardly representative of the population. And that was run by, the head of it was Mykhailo Vidashevsky, the famous Ukrainian historian who I've read many, many times in English. One of the few times you have a first-rate historian actually becoming a politician. So you had every point of view here. The best translation for some of them was autonomous federalists, those who certainly didn't want to secede entirely from Russia, whatever Russia was at this point. You had those to the left, Ukrainian Social Democratic Labor Party, Ukrainian Party of Socialist Revolutionaries, Ukrainian People's Party. But even at that point, even they weren't looking for that. You might want to call some of these National Socialists in the sense that they were both nationalists and socialists. So, the struggle of this Rada, this is a Rada era in the very beginning, barely was able to function for the most part, no fault of its own. The struggle for the national territorial autonomy. They were preparing for elections for the Constituent Assembly to resolve the issue of Ukraine's relationship with the Russian now Republic. You know, sometimes the phrase Constituent Assembly, that was a sacred phrase that was, you know, that solved all problems. Everyone had a different point of view on it. But also, they accepted the provisional government, and they wanted to grant equal political rights to national minorities. But there was no consensus in any of these groups regarding the future status of Ukraine. The minority nationalists were led by Mikhanovsky. He wanted an immediate declaration of independence. But the far more numerous nationalists, or autonomists, some people call them, Mikhail Gidushevsky and for a time Vladimir Vinichenko, they saw Ukraine as an autonomous republic in a federal union with Russia, again, whatever Russia was. Under the Rada, the Ukrainian Central Democratic Republic was proclaimed. The UCR acted as the organizer and leader of the nationalist movement in general, and were told that it encompassed broad segments of the population. Well, those who live near Kiev, I guess. April 19th, 1917, the All-Ukrainian National Congress held in Kiev. You had 900 delegates from political parties all over the place. All kinds of political groups, unions, peasant, military, you know, labor, economic, cultural. Yaroshevsky was elected chairman of the Congress. Among them were representatives not only of Dnieper, Ukraine, but of Kuban, Galicia, military organizations, and about 600 others from Ukrainian institutions in Kiev. That's as far as you're going to go to get some kind of representative sample. And there, they sought autonomy. Of course, they always had autonomy. They always had autonomy under the Tsars. April 21st, elections were held for this the Central Rada. Gudishevsky was re-elected as the chairman of it by secret ballot. Same time, the deputies Vinichenko and Efimrov were elected. The executive body was a committee or the small council, and the UCR became the representative body of the Ukrainian nation, or so it was said. Same time, you had the first Ukrainian military congress in Kiev in May 18, 1917. They were supposed to have spoken for the military. They supported the demands of the Central Rada for the autonomy of Ukraine. They even elected a military general committee of 18 men, headed by Simon Petlura. Simon Petlura, you'll see him everywhere. He was a high-ranking Freemason, head of the directory. He kind of went wherever the winds were going. So we're in the era of the Rada. This is the first government, so to speak, after the fall of the monarchy. But even that itself is complex. You had a lot of different groups calling themselves Cossacks. Some legitimate, some weren't. October 1917, there were about 60,000 of them. You did have one legitimate Cossack force, and that was the 1st Ukrainian Corps under General Pavlo Skoropadsky. And he was elected the honorary chairman of all of them. He wanted to place his Ukrainianized regiment of 40,000 fighters at the disposal of the Rada. Believe it or not, Yaroshevsky and Vinichenko denied the need to have a regular army, which makes tons of sense during a global war and the Russian Civil War. They don't need an army. So with that kind of mentality, you know where this is going. Kerensky finally visited Kiev, and he met with Gerashevsky. They had a long talk. Apparently it wasn't successful. No one was happy. In early June of 1917, the provisional government rejected Ukrainian autonomy. The claim was that that it didn't recognize the Central Rada as a representative of the will of the Ukrainian nation. Which is probably true, but that's not the point. Now, under the Rada, they developed their own political thought, which is worthwhile. And they issued universals. Four of them. And they came as a result of this rejection from the provisional government. Keep in mind, people realized that the provisional government was quite weak, but who was going to replace them and what it meant for Ukraine was another matter entirely. The first one was issued in June of 1917. Of course, national autonomy. Central Council is the highest authority in Ukraine. Ukraine assumed the right to convene an all-Ukrainian constituent assembly to adopt any kind of laws that affect Ukraine. Hopes that an all-Russian constituent assembly in the future will adopt a decision to grant Ukraine autonomy. Formation of the Ukrainian government, June 15, 1917, the General Secretariat, headed by Vinichenko. Now the Rada became more institutionalized. The rejection of autonomy from Kerensky led to pretty fierce disputes in Kiev later on. The second was issued on July 16th. The invitation there was to join as a central government of representatives of non-Ukrainian nationalities, a promise never to tear Ukraine away from Russia, the recognition of the autonomy of Ukraine should be established by the all-Russian constituent assembly in the future. But what autonomy meant, what independence meant, it depended on who you're talking to. But on July 16th, they made it a point to say that Ukraine will never be separate from Russia. The provisional government by this time, of course, itself was in crisis. Both Lvov and Kerensky, but more the latter, significantly limited the rights of Ukraine as a autonomous entity. General Secretariat was proclaimed a body by the provisional government, but the powers extended to 5 of the 9 Ukrainian provinces. Then that was reduced and then eliminated eventually. Not that it really mattered very much. After the revolution, though, you have the third. Now you have somewhat of a stronger demand for independence. The abolition of landlordism, land ownership, transfer of land to peasants. You know, for the most part, 90% of Russian land was owned by the peasantry in one form or another. Ukraine was a little different, but not much. The establishment of the 8-hour workday, which was very tough in 1917, and state control over most production. To their chagrin, the right to assembly, strikes, and equality of languages. The constituent assembly in Ukraine was to be assembled on January 9th of 1918. amnesty for all those who were in prison for political reasons, the abolition of the death penalty, which was ignored. But this first government after the fall of the monarchy didn't have the unity. It didn't have the money. They could make statements like this. And for the most part, they were okay. From an Orthodox point of view, it didn't matter. But enforcing it in a country that large is another matter. December 4th, 1917, the Council of People's Commissars sent an ultimatum to the Central Rada. Remember, the Bolsheviks had taken over by this point. In fact, a civil war was now imposed on Ukraine. Didn't consider the Central Rada to be a representative of the Ukrainian people. Well, that gets more interesting as time goes on here. The fourth, the last one, January 22nd, 1918, starts off at the words, "From this day onward, the Ukrainian People's Republic becomes independent, subject to no one, a free, sovereign state of the Ukrainian people." Hence, the UNR became an independent state. This, of course, is during the Russian Civil War. So you have an offensive of Bolshevik troops on Kiev, the occupation of much of the Ukrainian territory by the Red Army, and they did nothing to make themselves loved by the population. The National Socialists tended to be non-Jews. Bolsheviks tended to be Jews. One of my favorite Ukrainian scholars, Ivan Rudnitsky, wrote this. "One wonders, then, why the federalist concept predominated in pre-revolutionary Ukrainian political thinking. Well, first, we must take into account that Ukraine had belonged to the Russian Empire for almost 250 years, although for the first century it had tremendous autonomous status, and had a prolonged connection, for a pronounced material and psychological bond between Ukraine and Russia proper. Despite their grievances against the centralism of Petersburg, Ukrainians did not feel themselves strangers in an empire to whose development many individuals of Ukrainian origin had made significant contributions. However, the acceptance of the empire, which appeared as an overwhelming and unshakable reality, could and did coexist in Ukrainian minds with an awareness of a distinct Ukrainian ethnic identity and an allegiance to the special political and cultural issues of the homeland." In and of itself, there's nothing really wrong with that either. Even after the Bolshevik coup of October 25-26, 1917, even after that, the pro-Russian or the Federalists, that option remained by far the most popular in Ukraine. However, the Rada condemned the coup and refused to recognize the power of the Bolsheviks. Because of this coup, because of the Bolsheviks taking over and forcing a civil war on them, well, the Russian government no longer existed. Which, from their point of view, was very true, and it makes a lot of sense. So that means there was a lot of pressure on the Rada and the General Secretariat to create a state in Ukraine. The Central Rada tried to extend its powers as far east as Kharkov, Kyrgyzstan, Kherson, Kursk, and Voronezh. That's the context of the Third Universal. But as far as they were concerned, under the Reds, there was no Russia. The UNR government planned to enter into a federative relations with those states that would be formed on the ruins of the Russian Empire. At least that was the thinking of the time. So the Rada and the Bolsheviks had to face off at one point or another. Again, the Civil War is still going on. Bolsheviks had zero support from the Ukrainian population. There were elections to the All-Russian Constituent Assembly. The Bolshevik Party received 10% of the votes in Ukraine. which is very high to me, Ukrainian parties received the remainder. Now, they didn't, I don't know what kind of elections these were. These, you know, they didn't have observers like they do today. In the big cities, there was nothing but voter intimidation. And that only angered the Bolsheviks. They demanded on a recount. In fact, they wanted to do the election over again. In fact, they wanted a recount of all, anything that was elected to the Central Rada, hoping to rig it enough to show how right they are in the world. So an armed intervention against the Rada was inevitable. Lenin, remember, and Trotsky and the rest of them all claimed that Ukraine would be totally autonomous on the USSR, even an independent nation. Remember, they had their own seat at the UN. But, of course, they liked that idea only if they had a puppet government there. The Central Rada, the All-Ukrainian Congress of Soviets, they were a tiny minority. They were 127 people out of 2,500 delegates. So they had to go east to Kharkov, kind of the capital of eastern Ukraine, in late 1917. And of course, they rigged the election entirely. But even with a rigged election, its 200 delegates represented only 89 councils out of more than 300 existing in that part of the world. But it didn't matter, though. Words meant more than reality. Didn't prevent the Congress from proclaiming the establishment of Soviet power in Ukraine. They announced very pompously the dissolution of the Central Rada and the General Secretariat in the beginning of the fight against counter-revolution. The war between the Bolsheviks and the UNR was about a month and a half, December 1917 to January 1918. But neither group, you know, they don't live in isolation. The Rada was not ready for a successful confrontation with the Reds. But at this point in time, the Rada really didn't have, you know, we mentioned before, they didn't think they needed an army. Very dramatic picture from the Ukrainian Bolshevik War was a bloody march of the Bolshevik troops led by Mikhail Muravyov into Kiev. He arrived at the Kruty railway station and had about 500 Kievan students and cadets trying to stop them. And of course, they were slaughtered. So Kruty became a symbol. Under the conditions of the Bolshevik offensive and negotiations with the UNR delegation in Brest, with that treaty with the German-Austrian bloc, on January 22nd, 1918, the Central Rada then adopted the Fourth Universal, where the independent state came from. And it's fully understandable as to why. It was the pinnacle of everything else that had come before. But who wants to be a part of what was happening in Petersburg or Moscow at this point? The forces near Kiev were just, they weren't up to it. The Red Army had a 20-fold advantage in manpower and at least a 40-fold advantage in armament and materiel, I should say. UNR leadership was unable to organize combat-ready armed forces. But rather than being magnanimous about it, January 26, 1918, Soviet troops entered Kiev. And they started killing people. They started rounding people up. Central Rada moved to Zhytomyr and Sarny, places, you know, far away from the area. Maybe the Central Rada can get external assistance. See, because the Fourth Universal gave the UNR the right to have diplomatic relationships with other states because it was independent. They launched, that's the Brest Peace Treaty, February 9th, 1918. Technically, Ukraine was no longer warring against the Central Powers. And Germany and Austria-Hungary undertook the help of the Central Rada to restore control over the entire territory. The Rada, in other words, had agreed to the introduction of German and Austrian troops into Ukraine. In return, they would assume the obligation to supply the Central Powers, or those two Central Powers, with food, production, raw materials, whatever they needed. But again, they expected agricultural machinery, machines of all kinds, actually. For the most part, in the West, Ukraine, during the war, they supported Austria-Hungary. That means that once this Brest Treaty was signed, Brest-Litovsk, that meant that the Central Powers were forced to recognize the independence of the UNR. That means the Ukrainian Bolshevik government was dissolved. And it was defeated. This was part of the territory given away in that treaty. The Bolsheviks, all of them Jews, expelled from Ukraine, went back to Russia. So, February to April 1918, German and Austrian troops, 450,000 combat-tested men, occupied the country, the entirety of it. The Central Rada returned. So while they didn't want an army, and it led to absolutely nothing but a disaster, they had the assistance of Germany. Now, it's unfortunate. This is not, you know, we have, it's going to happen again in the Second World War, that the Central Powers went a little far. They actually created an occupation regime. They created military field councils. They executed civilians. German officers took over agricultural production and methods, especially if they were giving the machinery. The Central Rada, which was never very powerful, certainly was now losing authority. And of course, this was all the fault of the Rada in the first place. They were helpless. Entrepreneurs, landowners, including peasant landowners, peasants of all kinds opposed the Central Rada, demanding the abolition of the land law and the restoration of private property. You couldn't go very far. The Soviets weren't there very long. Now, I don't want to consider that very brief takeover by the Bolsheviks as a new stage. This is still in the Rada stage. It didn't last long enough for that to matter. But because they didn't have any authority, you know, we know the difference between authority and power. Power is simply the coercive ability to get someone to do something, regardless if they want to do it or not. Authority is a right to do that. And now we're going to go to the second stage. And the best stage, in my opinion, of this era. And that was the election of Pavlo Skoropadsky, Cossack Hetman of all Ukraine. April 29th, 1918. The Central Rada was dispersed and no one cared. Pavlo Skoropadsky, who died in 1945 in Germany, he was from a Cossack family. You had a lot of people like Nestor Makhno were claiming to be Cossacks. They were not. He is a relative of the original Skoropadsky. He had tremendous military experience. He commanded a cavalry division, the Army Corps. He eventually became a general. He was both pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian. This is the reason I like him so much. They don't have to be opposed to one another. The main party that backed him was the Ukrainian Democratic Agrarian Party. And, of course, the military and the German troops. But he was not as dependent on the Germans as you might think. So the Central Rada was dissolved. Now we're in the second phase. He created a new parliament called the Sejm, which comes from the Polish. The Hetman had legislative and executive powers from his council of ministers. Hetman's guard essentially acted as the police force. It just wasn't possible to build a utopian multi-party democracy during the war. You have two wars going on. The Russian Civil War and World War I. But the truth is Skoropadsky was the only time in this era where Ukraine was doing well. Private ownership of land was restored. However, he demanded that land be given to the peasants for the larger landowners. In fact, he had a maximum that a landowner could have. He did what the Bolsheviks promised. But of course, the Bolsheviks promised it just to get it, just to get votes. They were just going to socialize it anyway. Property was returned to landlords who were mostly middle peasants. Here's what he said. I am a Russian person and a Russian officer. Due to the circumstances, I have to say and do absolutely not what I feel and want. This must be understood. I definitely looked and am looking, and my close, real Russian people know this. The future of Ukraine and Russia, that Ukraine must enter as an equal in the terms of the Federation. Times of command from Petersburg has passed. This is my deep conviction. Independence was necessary as the only opposition to Bolshevism. It was necessary to raise a strong nationalist movement. So he knew what was going on. November 14th of 1918, we're coming to the end now of the war. Hetman's constitution appeared, Federation of Ukraine. But he was only talking about a future non-Bolshevik Russia. And he said this. Now we have a new state task before us. The states of agreement have long been friends, a former unified Russian state. Now after great disturbances experienced by Russia, the conditions of its future existence must certainly change. The ancient power and strength of the old Russian state must be restored on other principles, federal principles. In this federation, Ukraine has to occupy one of the first places, has to be the first to take part in the creation of an all-Russian federation, the ultimate goal of which would be the restoration of Great Russia. Achieving this is a key to the well-being of all of Russia, as well as ensuring the economic and cultural development of the entire Ukrainian people on the solid foundation of national state identity. In other words, it's very simple. He was a Ukrainian nationalist who realized that Ukrainian nationalism only works when it exists as a part of a Russian Federation, where it exists almost the dominant partner, or at least an equal partner, with a non-Bolshevik Russia. Skoropadsky, of course, gets terrible press, always did, because he banned strikes, which is, during wartime, is such a crazy, most European states did that. However, more importantly, basic freedom, trade and business. You see economic growth for the very first time in that country. Financial reform, too. He introduced the hryvnia, placing Ukrainian capital in German banks. His government spent tremendous amounts on education and eventually had a huge budget surplus. I've mentioned this before. Skoropadsky was financing the White Army at one point. It's in my book, and it's in a bunch of other places. Ukraine was successful, independent country, in union with Russia, and he built an army of about 300,000. The Orthodox faith was declared the state religion, etc. He was a success. The most successful and consistent policy the Hetman government was in culture. So it was these pro-Russian people who built the modern Ukrainian idea. And it sounds odd to say that. That's why I wrote my book, Ukrainian Nationalism. So even in Russian-speaking areas, it was mandatory that you had to study the Ukrainian language secondarily. The history, the geography of Ukraine. Departments of Ukrainian language, literature, culture, history, everything were open at every university. This was very important. Foreign policy was aimed at maintaining diplomatic relations with Germany, Austria-Hungary, Switzerland, Turkey, Poland, Finland, and even in the fall of 1918 with Britain and France. So he declared a federation essentially with the whites in non-Bolshevik Russia. This was a problem, which didn't make a whole lot of sense, but he had no choice in the matter. And the Hetman was, well, the Hetman was essentially the closest thing that Ukraine had to a monarchy. In my opinion, that's what has to happen now. A strong Hetman like him needs to take over the government in Ukraine, a military coup, and rule like he did. A true Hetman would get the support of the population. He was the only remotely successful government during this period. Now, I've written on him quite a bit. His successes go way beyond that. But in 1918, he was financing the White Armies. I'll say that again. That's how much he was building in Ukraine. So, there was a problem. Problem was that among many Ukrainian elites at the time, Masonry was very prominent. The Masonic Directory, again, was named after the French Revolutionary Directory. It was created on the night of November 13th and 14th, 1918, by a block of kind of semi-socialist parties. Petlura himself was Grand Master of the revived Grand Lodge of Ukraine in 1919. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were many Masonic lodges in Ukraine. There was one blasphemously named St. Vladimir. The other one was Northern Lights in Kiev. It was Poseidon. Another one called Renaissance. Shevchenko, which existed in Kharkov. Love and Loyalty. The Blasphemy, one named for St. Cyril Methodius in Poltava. Unfortunately, Gorosevsky was a member of one of these. They all did. This directory eventually overthrew the Hetman, and Ukraine went down its path again. The directory consisted of five people: Andreevsky, Vinichenko, Makarenko, Plura himself, and Fyodor Shevets. Now, things changed over time, but it acted no differently than in the French Revolution. And here was their agenda. Knowing how successful the Hetman was, Hetman government was, this is what they were doing publicly. They wanted the restoration of the old Rada, but without the power of the Ukrainian Central Rada. So they wanted the idea, but not the institutions. To them, agrarian reform meant the elimination of private ownership of land. Introduction of state control over production and distribution of products of all kinds. The restoration of the 8-hour workday. And the right to trade union activity and to hold strikes. Some of these are contradictory, and they couldn't be enforced anyway. The directory was oriented towards the Entente rather than Germany or Austria-Hungary, but the Entente refused to recognize it. Part of the reason why they had some, the French had some military intervention in southern Ukraine. See, they accused Petluria of being an anti-Semite. The Bolsheviks created all kinds of nonsense about him. The Western allies demanded that the directory be reorganized. And once he's gone, we'll then provide assistance in the fight against the Bolsheviks. Which, of course, was nonsense because they already loved the Bolsheviks. The Entente never followed through on any of these promises, no matter who they're talking to. But being a Mason, here's what Petluria wrote on August 26, 1919. It is time to realize that the world Jewish population, their children, their women, was enslaved and deprived of its national freedom, just like we were here in Ukraine. It should not go anywhere away from us. It has been living with us since time immemorial, sharing our fate and misfortune with us. I decisively order that all those who might be inciting you to carry out pogroms be expelled from our army and tried as traitors to the motherland. Let the courts try them for their actions, without sparing the criminals the severest punishment according to the law. The government of the UNR, understanding that all harm the pogroms had inflicted on the state, has issued a proclamation to the entire population of the land with the appeal to oppose all measures by enemies that instigate pogroms against the Jewish population. It makes you smile to hear this garbage because there were pogroms, but only against Christians and Orthodox people all throughout Russia. The directory, or really whoever was running Ukraine at the time, but at this point, the only chance they ever had was the Hetman. But they were in a brutal neighborhood. In the north, you have the Bolshevik army waiting for them. But they had other fights to deal with. In the south, they had some infantry from the Entente to control assets. Then even the whites under General Denikin, who demanded a united and indivisible Russia, rejecting any kind of Ukrainian autonomy. And of course, in the west, you had a new problem. The new Polish army was formed. The directory was unable to protect the UNR because it did not have a combat-ready army. Again, it's the second time I'm saying that. Hetman came the closest to building something. Of course, any government of Ukraine is going to have to be somewhat dependent on one power or another. Russia makes the most sense, but in Western Ukraine, Austria-Hungary might work. The soldiers that were serving the Hetman simply went home once he was overthrown. Making matters worse, everyone and their mother was calling themselves a Cossack and running around and stealing from people. Atamanism, it was called. Not real Cossacks. Makhno was one of them, as I've mentioned. Nestor Makhno was not a Cossack. He had no Cossack background. He's considered to be one. But if the lack of unity existed in the first stage, some unity existed in the second stage. Now in here, the third stage, the directory, you have nothing. There is no unity among the people who are running this. The head of the directory eventually was Vladimir Tchaikovsky, who advocated the introduction of, get this, a Soviet system of power but without the Bolshevik dictatorial methods. I'll repeat that. He wants the Soviet system of power, but without the Bolshevik dictatorial methods. This doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But eventually, the search for compromises led to just... it led nowhere. I mean, the Soviet system of power required the dictatorship of the proletariat. Multi-party state doesn't make any sense. That's what socialism is. There's no option. You can't have alternatives. You can't have alternatives in a planned economy. You just have some profound thinking and you had some garbage like that. The directory never really had much authority. Any kind of agrarian reform was delayed. It didn't have the power to do it. You couldn't enforce it. You had various self-proclaimed atamans, the Lenin, Grigoryev, Makhno, all claiming to be Cossacks, rising up all over the place. And it's around that time that the Bolsheviks began a second war against the UNR. The directory eventually left Kiev. Its leadership found itself in international isolation, since the Entente did not support the idea of independent country there. And of course, now the war is over. There is no appeal to Germany or Austria-Hungary at this point. So, being principled politicians, they went to Poland. The Treaty of Warsaw was signed. It was an agreement between the Polish government and the government of the Directory. April 21st, 1920. It was basically the promise of Polish military assistance to the UNR in exchange for recognition of Poland's claims to some Western Ukrainian lands. The only reason it was signed at all, because, you know, the UNR directorate was desperate. The directorate was losing power everywhere, losing authority everywhere, especially in Galicia. Now, I want to have an aside here. There was another government in Ukraine, in the far west, the Western Ukrainian National Republic, which is the UNR. Again, these two didn't agree anyway. The UNR really saw Poland as the enemy, so they couldn't have been supporters of the Directory at all. And in this stage of weakness, the Red Army took Kiev again, February 5th, 1919. The Poles did respond. However, not before UNR troops were driven back to Volhynia, and there was the Ukrainian-Soviet war. It was very, very intense. The Directory, though, couldn't have a reform program that would satisfy the majority of the population at this point. The Directory had learned nothing from the Central Rada. Because of the alleged defeat of Germany and Austria-Hungary in World War I, they were stuck. Anyway, you do have, and this is not another stage, but you do have, it is another government, West Ukraine, also associated with the revolutionary events in Russia. And even more so, the ZUNR had Austro-Hungarian, especially Austrian troops, at its disposal. At one point, headed by Yevhen Petrushevich. He was a nationalist of a sort, and he was one of the creators of the Western Ukrainian Republic and his president. But under the directory, he eventually left for Austria. Especially after the agreement with Poland. So you had an uprising. Going back a little bit here. Late 1918, Lvov. In many major cities in the West. Take power into their own hands. And prepare again this magical constituent assembly. They were worried in the West of the rise of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Because the Poles had proclaimed that pretty early on. They were the only ones who had an army that could be dealt with. He was vaguely successful, but not nearly as much as the Hetman was. You had a basic constitution. You had some kind of elections, I guess. The Ukrainian People's Rada, he called it. It was permanently an economic crisis, so his agenda was the following. Monopoly over all grain, sale of tobacco, alcohol, agricultural products, cooperation with cooperative and financial organizations, whatever that means, resumption of railway transport, introduction of currency into circulation, the hryvnia and the benevets, and the adoption of the land law, agrarian reform again, for the 18th time, provided for the elimination of large land ownership and division of land among landless peasants. None of these governments, other than the Hetman, ever had the power to do this, even if they thought that was right. However, in the West, you did have some oil. The government failed to take control of oil production. It was owned by foreigners anyway. It couldn't stop inflation. It couldn't enforce anything. There was an attempt to unify the UNR and the ZUNR into a single state, but it's very difficult to do. Ukraine still really didn't have a territorial army or any kind of unity to fight for its national interests. The UNR had the did have a military force of their own. So you had this, you know, in 1919, you had this meeting in Sofia Square at Kiev that the two groups, you know, the Western and the rest of Ukraine, were going to unify. You had thousands of Kievans there, the army representative, other state, you know, diplomats. But it was just on paper. It may have had a political and ideological function, but it had no state or legal character. No conditions were ever developed for its implementation. It wasn't ratified by the governments of either state. It was an idea. Again, we're told that they thought that it was going to be something that would be solved by the Constituent Assembly. You study this era of Ukrainian history and you hear that phrase. It really is like a magical concept that's going to solve everyone's problems. Now, things get worse. Obviously, the fourth and final aspect of this is the Soviet takeover of Ukraine, or most of it. During the winter and spring of 1919, the Bolsheviks seized power in Ukraine for the second time. And it was called itself, as we all know, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, the Ukrainian SSR. They used their typical provisional committees, the Revkoms and Vonarevkoms, so provisional revolutionary committees and military revolutionary committees, overwhelmingly Jewish in competition, in composition, I'm sorry. Rejected by the peasantry. March 10th, 1919. The third All-Ukrainian Congress of Soviets in Kharkov. Ukrainian Socialist Soviet Republic was proclaimed. Again. As I said before, Lenin promised everyone that they were going to have these nations develop as semi-independent entities. Of course, he lied. It was just a way to spread Marxism. But for the time being, he demanded the spread of Ukrainianization. That's exactly how the communists were going to take over. Again, this obviously isn't the first time that that Leninists have tried to take over. Both in 1917, the first time, and 1919 now, neither Crimea nor many other Western many other territories were part of the territorial composition of the Ukrainian SSR. You still had, I mean, it was near the end, but you still had the whites backed into Crimea. They couldn't have transferred it to Ukraine as they wanted to do. And the capital, until 1934, of the Ukrainian SSR was in Kharkov, not Kiev. I said it before that both Lenin and Stalin, by the way, was put in charge of this. This was Stalin's project, not Lenin's. Even though Lenin agreed with it 100%. Then he reversed himself entirely. Once he took over, once they won, he shot the people who he had put in power. The first secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Ukraine was a Volga German named Emmanuel Kvitting. He was placed under capital punishment in 1937, but his influence against Ukrainian nationalism was substantial. Ukrainian Socialist Soviet Republic proclaimed, and the constitution, so-called, was adopted. Let me quote from it. This is the main ideological part of the constitution. Decisively breaking with the past, striving to destroy, together with the division of society into classes, also national oppression and national strife, the Ukrainian Socialist Soviet Republic declares its firm determination to join the United International Socialist Soviet Republic as soon as the conditions for its emergence are created. At the same time, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic declares its complete solidarity with currently existing Soviet republics and its decision to enter into the closest political affiliation with them, the joint struggle, the triumph of world communism, the revolution, and the closest cooperation in the field of communist construction, which is conceivable only on the international scale. Now, both Lenin and Stalin had written articles about how Ukraine was going to be created as a tremendously autonomous republic, almost totally independent, with its own language, everything but the church, of course. But as I said before, we're still in, this is a fourth takeover of the Soviet takeover and how it went. Ukrainization was the means whereby the Soviets then insinuated themselves into every aspect of the government. There wasn't much of a government by this time anyway. The phrase here in the Constitution, Ukrainian Socialist Soviet Republic declares its firm determination to join the United International Soviet Socialist Republic as soon as the conditions for its emergence are created. So here they're admitting the plan. They're admitting this is all nonsense. But still, for a long time, everyone had to study Ukrainian. They forced the Ukrainian language press, even before the creation of the USSR. Stalin called this the inevitable Ukrainization of the area. Here's what Stalin said. He's one of the ones who created this policy. And he said this at the 10th Congress of the party in 1921. It was recently said that the Ukrainian Republic and Ukrainian nationality are a German invention. Meanwhile, it is clear that Ukrainian nationality exists, and the development of its culture is a duty of communists. One cannot go against history. It is clear that if Russian elements still predominate in the cities of Ukraine, then over time, these cities will be inevitably Ukrainianized. Of course, all these people will be shot a little bit later. The one who created the Red Terror was Mykola Skripnik, who I don't think was Jewish. He was the People's Commissar for Education. He committed suicide in 1933. He was a supporter of an autonomous Ukrainian republic. He liked the idea of Ukrainization. But Skripnik came right out and said, the best way to achieve communism in Ukraine was to Ukrainianize it, only under our auspices. But of course, they were all opposed to Ukrainian nationalism. That was what was behind the sudden conversion of the Reds to nationalism. They weren't nationalists. It was a method. He's the same man who attacked nationalist deviations and the literary independence movement, Mykola Kilovsky, any other socialist parties representing Ukrainian interests, he wanted to destroy and did destroy. He destroyed any industry that was not dependent on the USSR, and again, shot himself in 1933 very conveniently. But it wasn't enough. In 1925, joint resolution of the All-Ukrainian Central Committee on measures for the urgent implementation of the complete Ukrainianization of the Soviet apparatus in Ukraine was issued. Everything had to be in Ukrainian. Anyone who rejected it was sent to the camps. And they did the exact opposite a decade later. At the time, the Bolsheviks still didn't have a majority. The People's Commissars of Ukraine was headed by the wealthy Christian Rakovsky, who's a Bulgarian, educated in France, who changed his name from Krasil Grigoryev Stanchov. Now, it's never made clear. I suspect him of being Jewish because of his close association with Trotsky and, of course, Gelfand. Peter Struve, the man who eventually rejected Bolshevism, here's what he wrote of him. Even then, he had a Middle Eastern elementary quality and a rudeness bordering on cruelty, which country under Turkish rule is the historical legacy of the superficial but cruel rule. This Middle Eastern rudeness was covered in Rakovsky with the gloss of French culture and softened by the grafting of that Russian systematicism. In other words, he was a Jew. So those, the Constitution, yeah, and this is the final phase. The Sovietization is going to go like this. As opposed, you had Ukrainianization is one thing, but the destruction of the Constitution went a little bit like this. Repression of anyone who uses hired labor for the purpose of making a profit. Anyone living on unearned income, like interest on capital, income from enterprises, receipts from property. Private traders, trade and commercial intermediaries. Monks and clergy, of course. Employees and agents of the former police, special groups, corps of gendarmes, Ukrainian security departments, as well as anyone connected to the royal house of Russia. Now, you might say, well, the Jews dominated trade. Why are they opposed to all of this all of a sudden? Why are they opposed to... They don't mention usury, by the way. But why are they opposed to it here? Well, the answer is that Jews found it far, 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 far more profitable to be a part of the Soviet government than in trading in trinkets. And they didn't care that no one in Ukraine liked this. One of the last offensives, the White Guard. Eventually it was. Kiev was captured August 30th, 1919. Soviet power fell again for the second time. You had Makhno's fake Cossacks being particularly active, trying to destroy the white supply lines and everything else. The Red Army overcame the resistance of the Directory, troops with what remained, and defeated Denikin's forces a short time later. Remnants of the right guard, White Guards concentrated in the Crimea shifted from Denikin to Wrangel, but by then it was too late. All the anti-communist Ukrainians were now in a desperate state. And again, as I mentioned, the negotiations with Poland, the Warsaw Treaty that I've already mentioned, tried to create a joint struggle against the Bolsheviks. I mentioned what the plan was. And then again, Polish-Ukrainian troops took Kiev on May 6, 1920. Although the Reds were mostly associated with Kharkov. But in July 1920, the Provisional Soviet Government was formed in Eastern Galicia, headed by Vladimir Zatonsky. This lasted until the retreat of the Soviet army to Galicia. However, the Poland and Trotsky had struck an armistice. Zatonsky was absolutely Jewish. It's not stated clearly anywhere. He was one of the men who suppressed the Kronstadt Uprising. He was a main figure in the Holodomor later on in Kiev and other regions. And he took great pleasure in dismantling mosaics and frescoes, the St. Michael's Golden Dome Monastery, and many other things. But it still meant a break between Poland and the anti-communist forces in Ukraine. Ukraine could muster 17,000 maybe at this point. He continued the war, but after many battles, the units of the Red Army that were forced to retreat to the territory occupied by Poles, where they were immediately disarmed and interred in Polish camps. So government exile, then UNR moved to Austria proper. Then in 1921, the Treaty of Riga was signed between Poland, the USSR, and Soviet Ukraine. Poland had to recognize the existence of an independent Soviet Ukraine, Eastern Galicia, Western Volhynia, Western Polesia, Kolm, Podlasia, that were ceded to Poland. So then, that was it. The Riga Treaty brought this sordid attempt for independent Ukraine to an end. Western Ukraine became part of Poland, Romania, Czechoslovakia. It wasn't until World War II that Stalin then took the rest of it. One last time, Wrangel's White Guard Army, which is still in Crimea, had to take advantage of the Soviet-Polish War and launch an offensive against Ukraine. June to November of 1920, Soviets won, finally establishing Soviet power in Crimea and elsewhere. And by 1921, Soviet power was established in Ukraine for the third time. Actually, the entire territory of the old Rada state came under Soviet control. And they weren't going to lose it again, of course, until 1991. Now, I'm hoping to God that clarifies things. You have four movements after the fall of the monarchy. You have the creation of the Rada state. A lot of disagreement, a lot of different political parties coming up out of nowhere. Made all kinds of promises they couldn't possibly carry out. And finally, that chaos was ended by the great Hetman, who unfortunately ruled for a short time. The only successful state of all of these, overthrown by the Masonic Directory under Petloria. Then finally, although it took a while, the battles back and forth to win between either the Ukrainians and the Soviets, the Poles and the Soviets, the Whites and the Soviets, it didn't matter. With the Entente fully supporting the Soviets by this point, the Red Army at this point, any forces that they had in Russia had nothing to do with the Red Army. I said that a million times. Those were the four stages here, to put it simply. Now, the Western Ukrainian thing was a separate matter. That just made it more difficult for everybody. They never really unified with them. They were very closely connected with Austria. And that government eventually moved to Austria proper after the war ended. And there you have it. I did my best to try to make this stuff as understandable as humanly possible. That's the movement. Those are the four basic elements. Ukrainian history from 1917, 1921, 1922, leaving a completely traumatized population behind. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.